First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for putting up this nice workshop here in Santa Barbara. It's my second visit to Santa Barbara, and I really appreciate the atmosphere and the spirit of these workshops. What I would like to discuss today actually is two topics. One of them is I would like to come back to this issue of the phase diagram of a Fermi gas, a polarized Fermi gas, so with imbalanced population, and show you that actually by making simple assumption at the unitarity limit, you can deduce some relationship between the various chemical potential and predict some phases which have been seen, for instance, in the MIT experiment. So the goal of this first part is to show you how you can get quantitative information by making a minimum of assumptions, but at unitarity limit, not using BCS theory. And in the second part, I will introduce a method which we find particularly appealing for the Fermi gases, which is using two-photon Raman spectroscopy to look at the single particle excitation in Fermi gases. So this technique has been used a lot in the case of Bose gases as an output coupler for Bose-Einstein condensate, as to excite phonons and to study phonons and so forth. But in the case of Fermi gases, it's particularly interesting because, as I will show you, it will enable you to map the Fermi surface even in the strongly interacting regime and to look at the single particle excitations. So in the first part, actually, will be mostly based on the work of Frédéric Chevy, who is a permanent member in our group at ENS. Frédéric is right here. And we had also a nice discussion and collaboration actually with a group in Trento, Carlos Lobo, Riccati, Giorgini, Stringari, and Roland Combesco as well. And in the second part, on the Raman spectroscopy, this is a work done by Tin-Lung Dao, Antoine Georges, Jean Dalibard, Jacopo Caruzotto, and myself. So as I said, these are the two parts that I will discuss. Again, the strongly interacting fermions and unitarity with imbalanced spin population, and here are the reference by Frédéric, and the measurement of single particle excitations in strongly interacting Fermi gas, and I will give you examples how the stimulated Raman spectroscopy can be used to get information on the excitation of the system. So in the first part, let me just recall very briefly, this has been done yesterday, but that the BCS theory actually implies pairing at the edge of the Fermi surface, and so if the two Fermi surfaces are matched, you are in the situation where the two chemical potentials are equal. And the question is now when you introduce mismatch density, and so when you have a different chemical potential, I will call mu up in all this talk the majority component and mu down the minority component. And what is the existence or nature actually of superfluid phase when this spin population is imbalanced? This has been a long problem. This has been discussed already yesterday. And this mismatch can be done either by changing the populations or by using atoms with different masses. And there are examples, as was mentioned yesterday, superconductors in magnetic field or quark matter do have this situation. So let me just introduce the Fermi energy for each of the species, up and down, h bar square divided by 2n times 6 pi square times the density at the power 2/3. So as was said yesterday also, it was realized very long ago actually that the BCS state actually was stable with respect to small imbalance in chemical potential. And this is easily seen by using the ground potential, h minus mu n up minus mu down and down here. And let's assume that mu up is greater than mu down, that I convert a particle of the minority component into a majority component. And as this quantity is fulfilled, so this will decrease the ground potential energy. Here, this will go down. But of course, this can be done only at the expense of breaking a pair. And so this costs the gap delta. And so we see immediately by this argument that the pair state actually is stable for small imbalance in population as soon as this quantity is fulfilled. But of course, this is not all of the story. There are several phases which have been predicted. I will not have time to go into detail by Carlson and colleagues. Polarized phase, FFLO phase, which had been discussed also yesterday by Dan Shea. And some internal gap phase, Sarma phase, or bridge pair phase, in which you have a gap which appears in the majority component. So I apologize for this list, which is probably not complete, and there has been an avalanche of recent publications, and many of the contributors are in the room here. And so what I would like to do now is to introduce actually to work at unitarity and justify why this is interesting. Because we know that at unitarity, the scattering length drops out of the problem. So most of the intensive quantity of the gas can be related to the quantity of the ideal gas by numbers, actually. And one of them is this famous relationship, the relationship between the chemical potential and the Fermi energy. At unitarity, it is a single number which has been both calculated for balance case and measured. And I assume, actually, that this number is known. I call it psi times the Fermi energy. We use, as I said before, grand canonical description, and we'll make, to compare to experiment, we'll make local density approximation. And finally, this is a T equals zero approach, very simple approach at zero temperature. So what we would like to do now is to see, actually in more detail, what we can get from the MIT or Rice experiment here. MIT actually is seeing three phases that are shown here on this graph, a central core which is fully paired, superfluid fully paired core, and this has been seen actually by a rotation experiment, a minority component actually which drops to zero at some value of the radius in the trap, and eventually a majority component, the red curve, actually, which is a fully polarized rim in the trap. So these are images in time of light expansion. And so there is indeed an intermediate mixture here, which is three phases, fully paired, intermediate, and fully polarized rim. On the contrary, the Rice experiment apparently sees only two two phases, a majority component. So Randy showed a better picture than this one, but this one was in the early paper. And the majority component is pushed away from the center here on the side in the elongated trap. So these are the two examples that I would like to discuss briefly. A very important issue is that it has been proven by the rotation experiments of MIT that indeed the central part is superfluid by this beautiful image which shows that when the imbalance is not too large, actually here there are no superfluid core, but near this point here, for relatively small imbalance, actually, you have indeed a superfluid character as demonstrated by this nice vortex lattices. Here is plotted an important parameter, which is as a function of the misbalance, N1 minus N2 divided by N1 plus N2, the condensed fraction, which is the central bright spot here in which the vortex are located. And you see here, obviously, that for various detuning from the Feshbach resonance, the red curve is Feshbach resonance, you see that you have some kind of standard misbalance beyond which there is no superfluid phase. So this is an important thing. For large imbalance, actually, apparently the system does not sustain a superfluid phase. So now I turn to the theoretical description, just by recalling that at unitarity you have a considerable simplification of the theory, because any intensive physical quantity, like the density or the pressure, normally it depends on the volume of the both chemical potential, mu up, mu down, the mass, h bar, and A. But at unitarity, you can factorize this as a unit ideal Fermi gas quantity, which will depend then on mu, m, h bar. As A is infinity, it drops out of the problem, times a function, a single function of the ratio between the chemical potential, mu down, divided by mu up. So you see that this is introducing a single parameter, which is the ratio of the chemical potential mu down and mu up, where Q naught is the value of the ideal Fermi gas. And this is the relation for the chemical potential of the majority component. And so at Feshbach resonance, A is equal to infinity, and this ratio, Q divided by Q naught for the Fermi gas, is simply a function that I call G of mu down divided by mu up only. And so the first application, if I take the density, for instance, this is what I said before. The density is simply proportional to mu up at the power 3/2. If I invert this relation, I get the relation between the chemical potential and the density like this. And this is a number, a numerical number times the Fermi energy. And this is what we call the unitarity regime or universal regime. This xi parameter has been determined in a number of experiments. And in 2004, here at KITP, I presented a value of 0.41 that we have slightly changed a little bit because now we know the position of the resonance a little better. And there are other values which have been measured both on Nickium-6 at Rice, Innsbruck, and Duke, and also at Gila, which shows the universality of this parameter, actually, because 0.46. So there is quite good agreement, actually, among the experimental value. And this has been also calculated by quantum Monte Carlo techniques or various approaches. And let me just quote that the BCS value is 0.59, so it differs by essentially 50% from the true value on resonance. So in other words, the BCS theory will probably give a qualitative description of the phases, but cannot give quantitative answer at the unitarity limit. So now I would like to show one thing which is rather important, which is that let us ask what are the eigenstates of the ground potential in the case of if-balanced population. I know that I have simple limiting cases. When I have a single component ideal gas, I know that the ground potential omega can be written as the ideal gas ground potential omega naught. And I know a second eigenstate, which is a fully paired superfluid, in particular when the two populations are equal. So I have at least two eigenstates for the system. And the question is that what is the lowest state of the system? And so it was shown, actually, that if I introduce the ground potential for the balanced system, omega prime here, h minus mu, n up minus plus n down, actually, if I introduce this eigenstate, superfluid state for chemical potential of mu, I have this quantity, n commutes with omega prime, so I have the operator n up times the superfluid state, it's equal n down, because it is balanced times the superfluid state for chemical potential mu, equal n times the superfluid state. So it's an eigenstate here. And when I write the ground potential now for imbalance case, h minus mu up n up minus mu down n down, I write it in the sum of mu up plus mu down divided by 2 and mu up minus mu down divided by 2. I find also that the superfluid state for a chemical potential 1/2 of mu up plus mu down is also an eigenstate of the balance case. Therefore, I have the two limiting exact eigenstates in the system, even in the imbalance case. So we can then write a simple diagram in which we will plot the ratio of the pressure divided by the pressure in the ideal gas as a function of the parameter I introduced before, the ratio of the chemical potential between minority component and majority component. Let me recall that the ground potential omega is simply related to the pressure and the volume by omega equal minus PV. So reducing the energy of the ground potential amounts to look for the phase with the highest pressure. So I will look at a phase diagram in which I want to have the pressure as high as possible as compared to the pressure of the ideal gas. And the Gibbs-Duhem relation gives me also that the total derivative of the pressure is the sum of the density times the partial derivative, actually, of the chemical potential, mu up or mu down. So essentially, we just need to know the density as a function of the chemical potential. So there is one example which is very simple. If I have a majority component, the pressure in a fully polarized ideal gas is simply P naught. And so in this unit, this is one. So this is one state in which I have, for instance, a very little number of spin-down atoms. This is correspond to one phase, one eigenstate for very small amount of spin down particles. I know also that in the case of the balanced case, I have the fully paired superfluid. So I know that the pressure, which I can calculate by this simple formula on resonance, this is the pressure of the ideal gas times a numerical factor, 1 plus eta, where eta is this quantity, times divided by 2 psi at the power 3/2. So when the two chemical potentials are equal right here, the pressure actually exceeds that of the fully polarized ideal gas. This simply shows that, indeed, for small spin imbalance, the superfluid state has higher pressure, therefore has lower ground potential energy, and therefore will be the favored phase in this system. So in this case, you see one critical point, which is very interesting, which is right here, when these two phases cross. This is the value of this eta parameter for which the system might undergo a phase transition between the polarized system and the fully paired system. This can be calculated, and this is given by this expression, which is on the order of minus 0.1. And so this quantity is close to minus 0.1. And actually, from the MIT experiment, it appears a third phase, and which I quote with this question mark here, which means that if this phase appears, it must have a higher pressure than the two other phases, at least in some parameter range, as a function of this ratio here. So let me introduce two crucial parameters, eta beta, which is the appearance of this phase from the fully polarized ideal gas here, when I put a sufficiently large number of down spin components. So I introduce this first crossing point, which will indicate the first transition between the two phases. This phase has higher pressure than the other two. Perhaps we will show indeed that this is the case, but if this is the kind of shape, then there is a second interesting point when eta alpha, introduce eta alpha, when the pressure in this phase actually reaches the pressure of the fully paired superfluid. And so I will discuss now why these two values are interesting, and obviously from this graph and also from the convexity of the dependence on pressure as a function of this parameter, you can show that this curve must be with a positive second curvature, positive curvature, because the partial derivatives are density and densities are positive quantity. So we see immediately on this graph that we should have eta alpha greater than eta critical, for which I have this change between these two possible phases, greater than the eta beta, in which I have the disappearance of the mixed phase in favor of the singly polarized phase. So can we prove, actually, theoretically, that this intermediate phase can exist? And what is the general property of this mixed branch? Actually, this can be done relatively easily by calculating the energy E of a single impurity atom immersed in a Fermi C of a majority component. And so if I have a single particle, this is the definition, this energy is exactly mu down, at the limit where the density of the spin down particle tends to zero by positive value. And then, as I said before, the derivative of the pressure with respect to chemical potential is a positive quantity. This is upwards curvature for the curve. So then I have two situations. I have a situation like this one, whether if this energy is such that the eta beta is smaller than the critical value, which is a crossing between the fully paired superfluid phase and the ideal gas pressure here, then this phase can exist, will be stable, because it has a higher pressure than the polarized phase. And so the new branch, this new branch in yellow here, would be stable. Or in another case, I can have this situation. If this eta beta value is larger than the critical value eta c between the ideal gas and the fully paired phase, so this dark curve here, then this new branch will be unstable, and the gas will have only two phases, this one and this one. And so you can calculate actually this energy, and Frédéric found a simple way to calculate this energy by making a variational approach. Variational ansatz, actually. So here is the Hamiltonian, so I have not much time to enter into the detail, but just to show you that this variational ansatz was very simple. You choose this one impurity, and you will restrict the effect of the interactions to the formation of a single particle hole pair. So the trial wave function is psi equal the function of a Fermi, ideal Fermi gas, which is this blue curve, which I call zero, with an amplitude phi naught, which is a zero momentum impurity at the center of this Fermi gas, plus a sum over knq of phi kq times this gets here, kq, which corresponds simply to the collision between the impurity and an atom in the Fermi C, a single collision actually, which produces a hole with momentum q and a fermion actually outside of the Fermi sphere with momentum k. So by momentum conservation, the impurity should get q minus k momentum here in this Fermi sphere. So then minimizing, actually, the energy with respect to phi naught and phi kq, the coefficient I've shown before, you get an equation, a relatively ugly equation, which is an implicit equation relating the energy to the energy with the other things. You renormalize things and so forth. And eventually, you find the following thing, that at the unitarity limit, this energy is minus 0.60 times the Fermi energy of the majority component here. So it shows that the eta beta parameter, remember, which was the mu down over mu up for the phase separation between polarized gas and the mixed phase, must be less, because this is a variational approach, less than minus 0.606, actually. And this was nicely confirmed by the Monte Carlo simulation of the group in Trento, Giorgini and Carlos Lobo, that they found eta beta equal minus 0.58 here. And let me recall that in the BCS theory, this eta beta parameter actually is indeed zero. So there is strong disagreement. Why is this good agreement between the Monte Carlo and the simple variational approach? It turns out actually that the wave function, despite of the strong unitarity limit, means strong interactions between the single particle and the Fermi C, there is a relatively weak excitation of the pair here. So the amplitude of these coefficients, actually, the sum of this, all these coefficients, is only 0.2. So the Fermi C, in a sense, is not that much perturbed by the strongly interacting particle. And this is why, actually, this very simple variational approach gives a good agreement with the Monte Carlo simulation. So now we are in a position to derive quantitatively some data on the MIT results. Let's call R alpha in the trap the radius of the disappearance of the superfluid phase, R beta, the radius at which the mixed phase disappears, the blue curve, mixed phase of the minority component here, and R up, the maximum, the radius of the wings of the polarized gas. And actually you can write in the local density approximation here, chemical potential as a chemical potential at center of the trap minus the potential V of R for both spins, for both chemical potentials. And as you know, the outer radius of the majority component will be given by this equation, U up of R up equals zero. The radius of the minority component R beta that I introduced before is given by this eta beta parameter, this region where I have a transition between the mixed phase and the fully polarized phase. So at this point, the ratio of the chemical potential mu down divided by mu up at R beta is equal to this value of minus 0.6. And finally, R alpha is the radius of the superfluid core. And at this region, then I have the ratio mu down over mu up at R alpha, which is exactly equal to the parameter eta alpha that I introduced before. So then you can measure this quantity and introduce a single parameter, which is Q here, the difference between these transitions, eta alpha minus eta beta divided by 1 minus eta beta, and plot this ratio as a function of Q, essentially. And so this is measured in the experiment, this is measured in the experiment, and Q will be a parameter that we can extract from the data. And for this value of Q, 0.32, you get this relation between the superfluid core and the minority component radius. And this is the theory curve, actually. So you find, indeed, that there is a threshold. So if the imbalance is too large, so this is a region of large imbalance, there is no superfluid component. And here, in this region, actually, you start to see a non-zero superfluid component. And this is fitting very well by this square root dependence that I've shown on the previous formula, so here, for this value of Q. And here you start to see deviation, and let me just mention that these deviations correspond to very small imbalance. So it means that the condensed fraction should go to 1, apparently it doesn't go to 1. So perhaps there is temperature effects or some other effects, but the shape of the curve here is nicely reproduces actually the MIT experiment. So from this data, actually you can get improved bounds on the phase transition regions, the eta beta and eta alpha region. From this value of Q of 0.32, you can get that this eta beta parameter for the phase transition between the polarized, fully polarized phase and the mixed phase in yellow here is minus 0.60, so it's well confined. And the eta alpha, the transition to the superfluid phase, actually is close to minus 0.1 with these bounds. Let me remember that this is the ratio mu down over mu up for these various phase transitions. And so based on the convexity of the pressure in this diagram, actually, the real equation of state as a function of this imbalance parameter will be below this yellow curve here. So it's rather well confined actually between these two parameters. So now there are plenty of questions. What is a real microscopic description of this mixed phase and things like that? So on the other hand, the Rice experiment gives a little bit of mystery here, because this Rice experiment can be described by a two-phase scenario, fully compatible with a two-phase only scenario, and with no adjustable parameter, Frédéric was able to find actually this dependence for the radius in unit of Thomas Fermi radius for the majority component and the minority component. And on this graph, there is one problem that when we take this polarization of N1 minus A2 divided by N1 plus N2 on the order of 0.7, this would correspond to a Q value of 0.16 instead of 0.32, which is in strong disagreement with the MIT value. And it also contradicts the theoretical bounds that I've shown before, that Q must be larger than 0.31. So there is a mystery here, and people like Eric Müller and colleagues have thought that what is the effect of surface tension and things like that. But so far, this is still not understood, the nature of the discrepancy, and this has been discussed a little bit yesterday. So I will stop here for the first part and spend the last 5 minutes on the second part. What have we learned here in this little exercise? That we can predict that there will be at least 3 homogeneous phases in the phase diagram in the case of imbalanced unitarity Fermi gases. The local density approximation is valid, obviously, and this has been shown by the Landship profile analysis at the MIT. And we can deduce some strong bounds, actually, on this phase separation, the ratio of the chemical potentials for the various phases. But of course, there are still some unanswered questions. What is the nature of this discrepancy? What is the microscopic nature of this intermediate phase? And of course, there are a number of things that you want to study in this system, the dynamical properties, the collective modes in the imbalance situation, to learn more about these various phases. And also the response to RF excitation, as was mentioned yesterday by Wolfgang. What is the response of the system to RF excitation? Here. So you see, this is far from being the whole story. What are temperature effects and things like that? But this is a very open situation right now. Now, in the last part, I would like to discuss a little bit a method of using stimulated Raman spectroscopy to probe the single excitation in a Fermi gas. And so this is the work done with Antoine Georges and Tinung Dao and Jean Dalibar in our group. And let me recall a little bit the basics of the excitations in Fermi gas. So in a simple Fermi liquid theory, low energy excitations are built out of quasi-particles, which have a dispersion relation given on a given point on the Fermi surface. So I call psi k, this dispersion relation, is proportional to the Fermi, V Fermi, which depends on the position of the Fermi sphere, so it depends on kf. Scalar product times k over minus kf. And this excitation actually have some lifetime. There might be incoherent excitations and some coherent excitations. And they have a lifetime which I call gamma k minus 1. And the Fermi surface simply defined by the region in momentum space where this excitation energy vanishes, psi kf equals 0. And it turns out that in ITC cupped supraconductor, in the normal phase, there are strong deviations actually to the equation for the quasi-particle excitations. There is in particular, as I'm going to show in 1 minute, anisotropic behavior of this excitation in the normal phase. So it is very interesting then to try to probe directly what we call the one-particle correlator, which is the average value of this quantity, psi dagger RT, psi dagger psi, psi r prime t prime for one particle actually, and not the two particle correlator, which is standardly used in the Bragg spectroscopy or noise correlation experiment, where you have access to quantities of this sort, psi dagger rt, psi rt, psi dagger r prime t prime, psi r prime t prime here. So here it is, on the contrary, in the case of fermion, very interesting to probe this quantity, and this can be done by two-photon Raman spectroscopy. As I'm going to show you, this will give direct access to the Fermi surface, not only in the weakly interacting case, which is also seen by the nice Zurich experiment by time of light, but you can also access to the Fermi surface in the strongly interacting regime, which is interesting, actually. And you can do this actually in a momentum resolved way, which is simply using the momentum transfer of the Raman process. So here is a little description of what is proposed. So here is the energy, the Fermi energy, and we will shine on the sample actually two laser beams, momentum K1 frequency omega 1, momentum K2 frequency omega 2, tuned to Faraday tuned from an excited state. It's a Raman process. And we will transfer atoms from one of the two strongly interacting states. For instance, alpha in the case of lithium-6 can be one of the two lower states, the one or two states. And the beta state here, it is important in this technique that this beta state does not interact with alpha or alpha prime. So in the case of lithium, you must take the level, well, you must. You can do it also probably with level 3 also, but it's more interesting to do it with level 6, the one which has the higher energy as a function of magnetic field, simply because this state then does not interact with the alpha or alpha prime state. So this is an important issue that we want to have this state initially empty and weakly interacting with the rest of the system. And so this technique actually is very similar to what is called ARPES in condensed matter physics, angle resolved photo emission spectroscopy. Here you would like to give momentum to the system and measure the response function R of Q and omega. Omega is detuning, Q is a momentum transfer, K1 minus K2, as a function of this perturbation. And so you can write this as a time integral times an exponential factor, I omega t minus q r minus r prime, which comes from the Raman process, times the propagator of the atoms in level beta, g beta of r prime t here, that will be very simple because they do not interact together, times this correlator, single function correlator, psi alpha dagger, r t, psi alpha r prime at time t equals 0. And so by this technique, if you are able to plot R of Q and omega, you have a nice selectivity in momentum, K1 minus K2, and also a selectivity in energy. And this will actually give us access to the Fermi surface. So I have perhaps not have 2 minutes.
Yes, 2 minutes.
Okay, not too much time to describe this in detail, but just to show you actually that the resonance condition will be fulfilled near the threshold at the Fermi surface for the excitation. And we will assume a phenomenological form that there is a width for the quasi-particle spectrum excitation near the Fermi surface, and this width is given here. And so here is a case of a weakly interacting or non-interacting fermion, and I take a spectrum in a lattice, in a 2D square lattice, which is a standard homogeneous, you know, excitation spectrum, psi k times the tunnel rate alpha times cos kx plus cos ky minus mu here, and you find indeed that you get a nice description of the Fermi surface for this filling factor in the lattice. Here, nothing new in this situation. But when you take a more exotic gap parameter, for instance, so it's a model, so it's not a theory, it's simply taking a model pseudo gap with D wave symmetry in the lattice, then you find that for this set of parameters, actually, the Fermi surface is strongly deformed, with a very distinct behavior along what's called the nodal line here or anti-nodal line here. You find actually that here, with this kind of gap, the gap vanishes here, so you have indeed nice quasi-particle excitations along the nodal line, which are shown here by the strength of the response function R of Q and omega in the QXQY momentum here, so you have a strong response in red here, whereas here, near the anti-nodal direction, you have a gap. Actually, this gap is maximum here, and you see a suppression, actually, of the quasi-particle excitation in this direction. So this is just to give you an example that, indeed, you have access to the Fermi surface in non-conventional Fermi liquid excitations by this technique. And so, for instance, so of course, experimentalists like myself, we are not very much willing to take and, you know, put K vectors in 10 different angles to map all of these points here. So we would like rather to scan the detuning because this can be done by RF. And so we can ask the question, now if I sit along the nodal line here or along this point here in on top here, do I see a difference in the spectrum now? I scan the delta omega, so the detuning in units of the tunnel rate here normalized. And I see that along the nodal line, I have a peaked response function here, R of Q and omega, and also the spectral function A, which is related to this response function, is in dotted line here. So you have a, I have a well-picked response for the quasi-particle excitation as a function of detuning. On the other hand, if I look along the antinodal line, I see that the spectrum is totally different. There is a gap here with a maximum here at 2 delta dot here, and then it decreases here. So you have very clear distinction between the two behaviors along the nodal and antinodal line by this technique. Okay, and so now in the harmonic trap, of course, you have inhomogeneity. So this was done for the homogeneous system. You have an inhomogeneity, as usual, the density in the edge is lower. And so you will kind of fill up, in the weakly interacting case, the central region here, but you still have the edge here, which corresponds to the strongest density at the center of the trap. And again, with the local density approximation in the gap, you know, non-conventional pseudo-gap image, you still see very strong asymmetry between this direction and this direction here. So in the harmonic trap, the message that this physics remains totally visible by this technique. And so finally, let me just give you one update. We would like to test all these ideas actually on our experiment. And we have been working over the last 12 months actually to totally improve our experimental setup. This was the situation in December 2005. We broke our glass cell and we learned that the cold Fermi gases did not like to operate at atmospheric pressure. And now we have this new little glass cell with a slightly larger appendix. We are using new laser sources, 120 milliwatt diodes operating at 75 degrees C. They operate very nicely now. A new Zeeman slower. We have rebuilt our Yoffe-Pritchard trap, which is much more stable mechanically. And we use now a fiber laser, 120 watt fiber laser for the far detuned tripod trap. So right now we are doing again physics with this system, and we are able to trap 3 10 to the 10 lithium 7 atoms in the MOT, which will lead in this device to an expected increase of our quantum degenerate number for lithium 6 on the order by at least a factor of 10, which would be on the order of 10 to the 6, a few 10 to the 6. And so right now we are working probably at this time into the transfer into the magnetic trap, and looking forward to do new experiments on this imbalance situation and also on this Bragg two-photon Raman spectroscopy. So I thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Christoph. Questions?
This one?
No, the experimental data. The next slide.
Oh, there is no experimental data. This is theory.
Oh.
I should have. Okay. Sorry. And there is no noise here, so you should be suspicious.
Okay.
Only MIT has curve with yeah, it has not been done yet.
Christoph, the data that you showed was our low temperature data. The high temperature data that I showed yesterday actually does show the three regions that you discussed, the fully paired, the partially paired, and the normal phase. And they also agrees quite well with the Clarkston limit and presumably also Frederick's theory. So it's the high temperature data that we have actually agrees very well with MIT experiment, the theory, and so on. It's the low temperature data, which has the surface tension effects, which I guess is neglected in Frederick's theory. Which disagrees with it.
Yeah. But it's surprising because this is a T equals zero theory, huh?
Actually, I want to address the following point. If we first try to understand the situation at T equals zero, and Frédéric Chevy's theory and what you presented was at T equals zero,
yeah.
I think that shows that all the BCS type theories which do not show the third phase are in conflict with the rigorous proof which you have given. So therefore, they capture some of the physics, but they capture not the physics we are discussing here, namely the existence of a mixed state and the existence of a Clarkston limit. Let's just leave finite temperature completely out of the discussion. So I want to now follow Randy's lead and say, well, there is a question of surface tension. And you have nicely shown that what we are discussing here is an. So first of all, without surface tension, without surface tension, we would have a mixed phase, and we would have this Clarkson limit. Now, Randy says that the loophole is surface tension. Now, if we take your nice discussion of the different phases and the energy and eventually whatever wins is what has the most favorable free energy or so, if you put in surface tension, to the best of my knowledge, surface tension costs energy, and that would mean that the region of the phase diagram, which is phase separated, becomes less favorable in energy, and therefore any notion I have about surface tension would actually suppress, suppress energetically the phase-separated state even more, and therefore would shift actually the Clarkson limit to even lower values. So therefore, I think if we maintain that surface tension is positive, and it's only positive surface tension which can cause those deformations, that they cannot stabilize the phase-separated phase and push it to higher polarizations. So therefore, I think if you give a rigorous proof that without I think what you presented was like a rigorous proof that without surface tension, one cannot explain the phase diagram presented at Rice. And if you put in surface tension in the simplest way, it will actually make the discrepancy even bigger. So I think that would mean from everything we know, we have to suppose that distortions observed at high polarization are not related to superfluidity, but maybe to something else in mesoscopic samples. But we don't know what. And we are trying to do experiments in those directions.
I fully agree with what you said. Well, there might be other phases, you know, this is a minimum number of phases. You may find, you know, other phases. I mean, these are the minimum which appear by theoretical consideration at unitarity. So, and we've seen yesterday in some presentation by Dan that actually you expect in some part of the phase diagram some other phases to show up.
So I was interested in what the identity of that third phase was. So in contrast to what Wolfgang said, mean field theory predicts three phases. It predicts a fully, because you consider a fully polarized phase, a fully paired superfluid phase, but mean field theory also predicts a partially paired normal phase. And so I think that might be what that third phase is sorry, I said the wrong thing, a partially polarized normal phase. And I think that is that what that third phase is? Is a non-superfluid phase.
Well, it's a mixed phase.
But with no superfluidity in it,
well,
no pairing. But it's still
fade,
but polarized, because mean field theory predicts that as well.
Yes, but in a very narrow range, actually. So it is simply the range over which this phase occurs in mu up divided by mu down is pathologically narrow in the mean field theory, at least in in the simplest mean field theory. The diagram that you showed yesterday near
above polarization about 0.93 in mean field theory.
And so MIT data shows that this phase occurs much earlier than 0.93.
I think one more question and then we should move on.
I wanted to point out that there's one more contradiction that we have to keep reminding ourselves of. If indeed we accept that there is some upper critical polarization of 0.7 or 0.75 at unitarity, which Chevy and Wolfgang would agree on, this all is done in the context of a kind of Fermi gas description of that normal phase above PC, not a state where you would have an RF pairing gap. So we've still to reconcile this, the latest data we're hearing from MIT, the existence of a pairing gap, which has nothing to do with these Hartree-Fock-like corrections that are being addressed
but
here.
But here in this approach, there is no assumption other than the relationship between chemical potential and Fermi energy. So
I think these are Hartree-like corrections. I believe that's certainly true of the Stringari-Giorgini paper. They've deliberately set out to make it a Fermi
but
gas.
Nothing in Frederick's theory implies the existence of a gap or no gap or pseudo gap. This is just basic thermodynamics consideration based on the unitarity region.
Well, then I may just be speaking to the Monte Carlo then, to the Lobo et al. Paper.
Okay. And the what is surprising actually is this agreement between this variational wave function approach, very simplest, very simple problem of the single impurity embedded into a large Fermi C, and the agreement with the Monte Carlo.
Where there is no pairing gap, where it's precisely Fermi liquid theory to start with.
But at least it gives a bound, and so the true value is can be lower than that, but it is not higher than -0.6, for sure.
Okay, well, I think we should stop there. Thanks so much, Christoph, again. So the next talk is by Zoran Hadzibabic.